That helps.
Yeah, that helps.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Wednesday, February the 12th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing up on House Bill 5011 with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And at this time, Greg is coming back up, and Satish, they're telling me they want, want to wait until we get almost everyone here for your presentation. So, Greg, we'll work around. I guess you're going to do the response to questions. Greg.
Yes.
Proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Greg Malkasian, the Deputy Director of DCBS. This morning we have quite a little packet in front of you. It's a portfolio with a letter on top of it, and I'd like to just touch on what we've provided you in the letter, which are our attempts to provide answers to the questions that were raised yesterday. We had quite a discussion yesterday about accident rates for the logging industries and fatalities over time during Mr. DeLuca's presentation, and we've provided some information in the first area there about that, indicating that that total claims have declined 60.5% from 1988 to 2001. Claims in the logging rate declined 56.7% of the time. I think it might be valuable to just turn back to attachment one, which is on the back of the second page. And
which,
I think it,
which publication are you in?
The letter.
This one?
Yes.
Yeah, the letter that's
the letter
on the
top
of the packet.
And I think this gets really dead on to Representative Krieger's question yesterday about the number of people in the logging industry and the number of fatal claims that we discussed. If you look on the back of that, it's a table, and if you go down in the first column to 1988, and then the second column over from there shows the number of employees in the logging industry of 13,035, and then go almost all the way over to the fatal claims column, and under logging it shows 22. So we have 13,000, the height of the employees from in this period anyway, in logging with 22 fatalities. And in 2001, the very bottom line, those same columns, the employment in that industry went to 7,528, and there were five fatalities. So we're seeing a almost half of the number of people in the industry, so we have a decline, yet the fatality rate has gone down fourfold, or it's only less than a quarter. So I hope that that's helpful to you. And then we also had some questions regarding the industry mix, and we provided at attachment two some information there. And the question kind of was, well, the industry mix has changed substantially, and that might explain why we are so successful in the reduction, the accident reductions in the state of Oregon over this period. And the study that is a little bit dated, but that we feel still has value at attachment two, shows that the industry mix in the workforce in the private sector between 1988 and 1997 was responsible for 11.2% of the drop in the private sector total case incidence rate. So it's really not significant compared to the major drop that Mr. DeLuca was discussing yesterday. And then also related to this industry mix, we provided a draft press release that provides some additional information about that at attachment three. And then there was another question about, well, several members actually had questions about how money flows from this agency to the general fund and how that cash balance or cash is managed. So in the letter itself on page two, we provided a discussion about that. It's kind of mainly focusing on where those fees come that pass through to the general fund, the first few paragraphs, and then the rate and the fee setting approach. And then finally, we talk about some of the management issues, that this is a pretty dynamic model, and it requires us to ultimately leave here with the actions that you take on our budget and understand what the legislatively approved budget is, and then factor that into our model to determine any adjustments in our fees to support the fee balance methodology that's discussed here. And then finally, two more things. Senator Dukes, you had requested information about the publications that DFCAS has, and that is the portfolio underneath the letter. We've provided you the different types of educational material that the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities provides. And then also there was a question about the fees paid to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and that's attached to the letter as attachment 4, and it's a number of pages, I think maybe even 7 pages, of the different fees and the various programs that those fees flow to. And that concludes the presentation of the information that we felt would be helpful to you based on the questions that were raised. And then there was an overriding question, of course, that Satish was going to cover. And we're not quite ready for that,
That's correct.
So.
Yeah. We're waiting for all, if we get all the committee here, we'd like them to have it.
That's great.
So, Mr. Chair, I would think that we could go ahead and start with the OMIP presentation at this point.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rocky King will be coming up to present the OMIP. Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, also referred to as OMIP. Generally, that's the way most people have heard of it. I believe that we are the second to the last tab in the book, and I will be kind of giving an overview of what's in there by covering a little bit about OMIP's history, the organization, funding, programs, performance measures, and some of our accomplishments, and finally the budget presentation. And to understand the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, you need to kind of, I think, step back and picture that if you had cancer, if you had diabetes, if you had multiple sclerosis, if you had severe mental disorders, asthma, or severely overweight, and you worked for an employer who did not provide health insurance, then you would probably be denied health insurance in the private sector. In 1990, OMIP was established to serve those Oregonians who had chronic health conditions, who were denied access to private health insurance because of their pre-existing conditions. And we have, since that time, served over 29,000 Oregonians with about 9,300 currently enrolled. It is different than the OHP Medicaid program. This is kind of a semi-private health insurance company administered by the state for people who can afford to purchase health insurance but just are denied access in the private sector. And I don't know, Ms. Lamont, if you want me to go through that little egg diagram that sometimes is helpful to see where OMIP.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that he go ahead and do that.
And due to a question about kind of where does the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool fit in the larger context of the Oregon Health Plan, we have this what we call an egg chart that we've been using many years with doing a lot of the training with our stakeholders. Basically, the Oregon Health Plan has two components, and we often get confused. The first is it's a concept. Through a number of initiatives, 1987, 89, 91, the objective of the legislature was to provide access to health insurance and reduce the uninsurance rate from then an 18% down to a 12%. One component is the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, which is really where we provide health care services to the very low income. That has served and expanded about 100,000 additional people over the decade because of the expansions that occurred in 1993. But in terms of the concept, the Oregon Health Plan is much bigger. In 1987 and 89, they started the employer health plans through the Insurance Pool Governing Board. We started the high-risk pool in 1990, and those are private sector components. We had, again, the Medicaid expansion, which is the one that I think is at the forefront in some of the budget discussions right now, started in 1993. FEOP, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, where we help people purchase private health insurance, administered by the Insurance Pool Governing Board, was started in 1998. Again, that's private sector, working Oregonians helping them afford their employers' premiums. Insurance market reforms, where we really reformed the market in 1991, 93, 96 to make the health insurance market much more accessible and guaranteed issue for all group coverage within the state of Oregon. We had what's called the CHIP program, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, started by the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, DHS, in 1998. And then the Insurance Pool Governing Board has also for years been responsible for marketing information and outreach, a lot of training and working with small businesses and individuals, plugging them in to the private health care system. So when we think of Oregon Health Plan, you always have to look at it first from a conceptual standpoint, that it is a series of public and private initiatives. And then there's the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, which is the real budget cost driver within the DHS budget, which is called also the Oregon Health Plan. There's a variety of agencies and that administer these, and I have these listed below under policy, planning, program, and regulation. The programs are all run by the Insurance Pool Governing Board, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is a part of DCBS, and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, which is a part of Department of Human Services. Then you have the insurance market regulation, which is run, obviously, by the insurance division. You heard Joel Ariel yesterday. And I should say the success that Oregon had reducing its uninsurance rate from 18% down to a low of 10 to 11%, and for children, 22% down to 8%, was not because of the expansion of Medicaid, but was really the expansion of the private sector. We added 100,000 on the public rolls, but in the private sector, almost 400,000 to 500,000 people got insurance between 1990 and 2000. So it's really been that partnership between the state and between the private sector that has really pushed that uninsurance rate down. And now, because of the economy, obviously, we see that rate starting to go back up. I don't know, Ms. Chair, if that kind of gives you a good overview of those programs. Okay, Ms. Chair, getting back to OMIP now, the history, again, it started in 1990. We offered our first policies. About 29,000 Oregonians have been enrolled in the program at one time or another, about 9,300 now. I want to give you a picture of who we serve. Average age is between 50 and 55 years old. 60% are women. 42% have incomes less than $25,000. These are people with chronic health conditions that really have, over the years, a lot of difficulty accessing the private health care system because of those conditions. We are administered under DCBS, but we do have a board that makes all policy decisions relative to benefits, premiums, selection of a third-party administrator. So we kind of divide from the administrative standpoint, DCBS has responsibility for the budget and the personnel, and the board really is the, by statute, the group that provides all direction relative to the program and the program's operation. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool also, since 1990, has had a close relationship with the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And through interagency agreement, we administer all the programs and provide the management support services of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which includes the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program called FEOP, as well as marketing information and outreach, which is agent and stakeholder training, customer service around plugging people into the healthcare system. And these, again, are people that can afford health insurance but just are trying to get through the maze. Our state agency costs for the last 13 years have been under 7%, and that includes both the third-party administrator cost as well as the state agency. We have about a 1.5% administrative cost for the state and about a 4.5% or 5% administrative cost for the third-party administrator. We have three funding sources. First of all, remember, these are folks that theoretically can afford to pay for their health insurance. So the first funding source we have is premiums. And about 55 to 60% of the cost of our program is covered by the premiums paid by our enrollees. And their premiums are set at about 125%, or actually a little lower, by statute, of the standard premium charged anyone else in the private sector. So if you went to an insurer and they charged you $100 for a premium, our folks for that same policy, if we offered it, would pay about $125 or $120. So they pay some premium for getting into our program, and that covers, again, about 55 to 60% of the cost of the program. By statute, then, and our average premium, I should say, is about $348 per month per enrollee. Our average claims, though, are about $619 per month. So the question is, they pay the premium $348, but they incur costs of $619. How do we make up that difference? And by law, we have the ability to assess all health insurers in the state of Oregon to make up for those losses. And we do it on a pro rata basis. We look at how many people every insurer covers, and then divide that into the total amount of losses that we're going to incur for a period of time, and they're assessed. And that comes down into the premiums that all Oregonians pay. It is probably the most broad-based way of spreading the cost of these chronically ill individuals. We have about 2 million people that are covered through private health insurance, and each one of those policies and individuals ends up paying in their premium approximately $1.39 or $1.40 per month that goes through the system to help support the pool.
Senator Carter.
Can you tell me, obviously we're doing a subsidy, but that costs between $348 in terms of what the insurer pay and what the state pays back in case of injury accident. When it's spread out across the system, how much money do you think we're subsidizing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay.
You mean the total amount of our assessment?
Yeah. No, you said that an individual pays $348 a month for premium.
That's correct.
If this person becomes ill or something of that nature, the cost to the plan itself is approximately $600 and some odd dollars.
Correct.
So obviously the state is subsidizing that piece.
That's correct.
But spread out across the system, approximately how much you think we are paying on the average per sick time or per downtown that for a person?
Okay, Ms. Chair, Senator Carter, first of all, the average premium, $319,
yeah.
So you have about $175 or $275. That is spread among about 2 million insureds within the state. So it's pretty broad-based, more than it would be if it was just the working population.
So it's pennies, is my point.
Pardon?
It's the cost when it's across the state, if you average it out.
It's very small.
That's right.
Very
that's
small. That's correct.
Okay.
That's the $1.40 number.
It's about $1.40 per month per enrolled person in an insurance plan. And next biennium, because of growth, and we'll talk about that in a minute, it should go to a little above $2 to $2.50 per person. When you look at an average premium in the state, though, which may be $300 to $400 or $500 a person, that's a very small amount of that monthly cost. We also have a third.
And considering what the insurance premiums would be if all of these people were in the emergency room.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that would be correct. I would rather provide them with high blood pressure medication than deal with the stroke.
Does the average person with health insurance know that they're paying? They will be paying $2. Is there anything that would indicate that on their Oh, I didn't know. That's what I'm asking.
Mr. Chair.
That might be below average.
No.
Mr. Chair, they actually do not generally know that. However, in the group market, when a company, a Regents or an ODS or a Kaiser actually bids to a group, they will list out claims, administrative costs, portability costs, which is a way of funding people who leave group coverage, as well as OMIP costs. So the purchaser may know it. The individual that's enrolled in the plan would probably not. Okay, Mr. Chair, so we have premiums, assessments, and the third funding is a small amount through interest earnings. We, like an insurance company, have to keep a reserve for claims, and that earns interest and that accrues to us. That helps reduce then the assessments and the premiums in the long run to both the individuals and the insurance companies. There are two ways to get into two eligibility criteria to get into the pool. First is you go to a health insurer and you're denied coverage because of a health condition. The second is if you belong to a group plan, you leave that group plan, either fired, the company closes, whatever it may be, or an insurer just drops the group, and there is what is called portability coverage in this state. Every carrier must provide coverage once you leave that group for as long as you want to pay for it. But there are some situations where carriers aren't available to provide that coverage. An example would be in Southern Oregon, where we had managed care plans pull out. A lot of companies were left there without anybody to provide the coverage. We are a stopgap if they're not able to find that coverage when they lose their group coverage. Out of that 9,300, we have about 1,700 that we provide what is called portability coverage, in port meaning from group to something that will provide some continuity of care for you throughout a period of time until you locate other coverage. So we do provide those two eligibility functions. We, just like an insurance company, we provide options for folks. We have an indemnity plan, a preferred provider plan, a managed care plan, and a low-cost, low-benefit plan. The majority of people enroll in the preferred provider plan, very similar to what you have here at the state, although it is much higher cost sharing and deductibles. We have primarily a $500 deductible plan, an 80-20 copay, very similar to what most businesses in the state are currently offering. Should point out that our managed care plan, like all managed care in the state, has really contracted to the Portland, Salem, Eugene area. That used to be our most popular plan because it was the lowest cost, and we had the best experience in that plan, but the contraction of managed care has also impacted us. The program is administered by Blue Cross Blue Shield through a contract. Every 3 years, we put out a request for proposal and receive bids for people who are going to do eligibility, claims processing, premium collection, and data collection for us. And Blue Cross Blue Shield is the current administrator of that program and has done a really good job in partnership with us since the inception of the program. We're linked to the...
When will that be up for rebid, or... How long have we got in the 3 years?
Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that's another year, I think, before we put another RFP out. I think we're just starting our second year of that current contract.
Do you envision any problems with getting people to respond or getting companies to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think the last time we put an RFP out, we had three that responded. And most states, you'll have anywhere from one to five. There were years that they were the only person that responded, but the last 6 years, we've had multiple carriers or organizations respond.
Yesterday, I understand, well, today, that Rite Aid is supposed to be dropping out of the health plan. How is that going to affect... what's going to happen with the employer, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, Rite Aid still has a contract with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. So the health plan, the Medicaid portion, they may be pulling out, but they will continue for the OMIP population and for most private carriers to provide services. So it does not impact OMIP, per se.
Okay.
And we one of the things that we do when we put a request for proposal out is basically contract. They don't charge us for it, but we get access to the networks of whoever the administrative insurer is. So Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, we utilize their pharmacy management system, their network, and contracting with provider groups. So we have pretty good access. Our folks carry a commercial card, so when they walk into the dock, they don't know they're a part of OMIP. And we pay basically commercial rates, although contracted and negotiated. So our folks have pretty good access both in the pharmacy side as well as the doctor, primary care, and specialist side.
Representative Krieger.
Some of the single moms, single dads that have children work for a company that provides the insurance for them as the employee, but not for the family. And then, if you want it, it's available. But normally that premium per child is so high that they don't take that option. How do they fit into here anywhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, actually, they fit in here in the egg under the Family Health Insurance the Family Health Assurance Assistance Program, FEOP. And that was created by the legislature to help working Oregonians who made too much money to qualify for Medicaid, generally either worked for an employer who did not provide health insurance or worked for an employer who did, afford those premiums. We have a whole bunch of folks out there, about 150,000, that don't qualify for Medicaid but cannot afford their own premiums. An example is someone who works for an employer that will pay the $200 for the employee and not the $300. And FEOP was designed so that we'll go in and subsidize the dependent coverage, so either anywhere from 50% to 95% of the poverty or of the premium, depending on the poverty level, so that they can actually apply for and receive their group-based employment. If they don't have that available to them, we will then allow them to go out into the private sector on the individual market, purchase private health insurance, individual coverage, and FEOP will help subsidize that coverage. And that was expanded by, I believe, the May e-board to serve an additional 25,000 people. The governor's balanced budget has cut that back to about 15,000, and of course it's a part of the whole budget problems that we're having around the Oregon Health Plan and funding all of those. So we don't know how this is all going to come out over the next 3 or 4 months. But that was what FEOP was specifically designed for. Now when you go out into the individual market, about 30% of the people are turned down for coverage. It's that high right now. When things are going well and companies are making money, that drops to about 15%. But when it's a tough time for insurance companies, they tend not to take a lot of the health or unhealthy ones. 30% of the people that will go out and get coverage then will come into OMIP. And we actually have about 900 people in OMIP now that FEOP helps subsidize the purchase of the premium.
Mr. Chair, I would suspect that most of the committee members, when we leave the legislature, don't have insurance. We're going to fit in one of these circles.
Somewhere. The big money we've been making.
Yeah, big money.
Is that good? Okay. Getting back to Ms. Chair, is the strategic plan performance measures. We're tied to the benchmark of lowering the uninsurance rate, so our benchmark really is to enroll folks that are eligible. It's anticipated that there may be between 15 and 20,000 people at any time that would be eligible for the pool. So our job really is to do good outreach and try to help people find out about the program and get enrolled in the program. And that's the primary benchmark. The other one, obviously, is to keep our administrative cost under 10%. And for 13 years, it's been under 7.5%. We've been successful. We're going to try to continue to do that. And that, by the way, includes both the third-party administrative cost as well as the state agency cost. Some of the things that we want to focus on in the next year are to develop strategic initiatives to control utilization while maintaining the enrollees' health. It's easy to deny care and deny benefits. The hard part is making sure people get to their benefits and are able to get services, but at the same time make sure it's the most appropriate service and the least costly. That's always been and will continue to be a challenge for the insurance industry. We want to identify best practices and evidence-based medicine. We have an open-ended formulary that we now use. We want to see if we can build in a little bit more evidence-based to it, what works best versus just what works, and give incentives to those people to take those medications, for example, that work the best, not just those that work, and to do some sort of cost-benefit analysis with that. We want to enhance communications with our stakeholders. It just amazes us that we've been around for so many years and have trained hundreds and hundreds of agents every year. But we get calls from people who say, I never heard about you. So we're continue to go around and try to do as much stakeholder and training as we can. The other thing is we just want to do a better job of talking with our employees. For 3 years in a row, we have held public meetings with our enrollees. We just send out 9,000 letters and say we're going to be in your community, and we usually go to about 8 communities a year and invite folks in to come and listen to what their concerns are about our program, about their providers, about the benefits, about the costs. And it's a great time for us to have interaction with many of our enrollees. And I wish I would have done that in the first 5 or 6 years of the program. And it's only been really in the last 3 years we've tried to do that kind of outreach. We want to look at our funding mechanism, even though that it's very stable and the insurance industry has been behind us. The amount of the assessment is growing to cover those losses. So we continually want to work with the insurance industry to make sure it's as broad-based, fair, and as equitable as possible. And finally, we want to, I think, improve our third-party administration. We spend almost $100,000 a month on administering this program through our third-party administrator. We want to make sure that they're doing the job that we pay them to do and that we get up there and make sure they do eligibility correctly, that they're paying the right amounts to the right docs, and they're administering the benefits as we intended that they would be administered. Some of our accomplishments... We get every month a stack of reports about like this. Just tells us every claim, every doc, every illness. And our big challenge is how to take that down and put it into a workable set of information so that the board can make good policy decisions around benefit structures, and to do some major studies about what works and what doesn't work. One of the gastric bypass surgery is a good example. There's a big national move towards providing that as a service, and it's important to us to be able to track those cases to find out what the complications have been, what the cost of those complications have been, how successful have they been. So we're really trying to get that data down to something that really works for our board so we can make good decisions. We have implemented chronic case management. We have two full-time nurses that work with special cases. When somebody really has a major episode, we're able to put a nurse on the phone working with the doctor, the family, and the individual to make sure they can get through the system. When somebody runs out of a benefit in one part of the policy and it makes sense to do some trade-offs, we want to make sure they have continuity of care. Again, remember, these are people with very chronic illnesses that are generally lifelong that they've struggled with. We'll continue to do our public meetings. We've established what's called an external review process so that if someone disagrees with a decision that the third-party administrator has made or that we have made, we have a neutral party that we've contracted with that will look at the case and make a decision based on not looking at their pocketbook or our pocketbook or the client's pocketbook, but what's right in terms of the contract and what should have been done in that case. We will continue to use the Internet and expand that. We now can download applications, so we're hoping that we can do electronic signatures so people can actually apply online at some point. And finally, we want to increase our enrollment by about 2,000 individuals, 2,000 to 3,000 over the coming biennium. The budget is divided into two parts, a limited and non-limited. The limited budget covers only the state agency costs, and that is about $1.2 million. which is about what we had for this this last year. And that is for seven full-time equivalent staff who also, again, through interagency agreement, manage the insurance pool governing board programs. We also have a non-limited budget, and I believe that the budget request indicates about $242 million, which is a considerable increase over what we anticipated spending this year, which was about $113 million. And I want to put this in context. When the budget was put together, we were still looking at a major expansion of the FEOP program. Since that time, through decisions made by the legislature and the governor's office, that has been pulled back. So our revised figure would be about $172 million for the non-limited. I wish that we could have had a little bit more insight as to what was going to happen with the governor's recommended budget and could have given you those figures a little earlier, but I think we provided those to Ms. Lamont not long ago. We have seen some tremendous increases in the non-limited expenditures, and that is primarily for three reasons. One, you've got medical inflation that's running between 10 and 20% every single year. For small businesses, it's running between 20 and 30% every year. But ours is, for example, our premium increases were about 15% last year, and we continue to see that at between 10 and 15% for the next 2 years. Secondly, we've seen the population of OMIP grow from almost 5,000 to 6,000 last biennium to 9,300, and we'll end this biennium close to 10,000. We anticipate that'll grow to a little over 12,000 the next biennium. That is a major result of what's going on in our economy. As our economy tubes, more and more employers are not providing health insurance. And those folks are going out into the individual market, and when they can't get coverage because of pre-existing conditions, they'll come to us. So when people say, when will you see that trend start to go back down, my response is, I think when we see the economy get put back together, we'll see employers starting to provide coverage again, and those guys, both the men and women that are enrolled in the program, begin to get group coverage again, and that enrollment start to steady. That's kind of an overview of the program and the budget, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, thank you. How do we determine the enrollee premium?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the premium dollar is set by statute, and the statute says that we can charge up to 125% of an equal, a standard premium in the private sector. So we're kind of tied to whatever goes on in the private sector. When our premiums go up 15%, generally that means the private sector premiums have gone up 10 to 20%. We don't have to be exact. In fact, we are probably closer to 110% right now, because the board made a decision based on our enrollment and where their incomes are that affordability continues to be an issue for our folks in our program. So it's a little under 125. The portability folks, the 1,700 that have lost group coverage, we charge 100%. That is, we charge exactly what they would have been charged if they would have had portability from a carrier. So there is no surcharge to those folks.
Okay. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yep. I'm hoping I can encourage you. Okay. Can you go here for a second?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since we don't have a full committee, I guess we'll wait for Satish's for just a little bit more. And
I think,
might as well go ahead.
Yeah, I started to stop, but I think Senator Carter is just outside and will probably take it back. So let's do that now. Satish, you're going to deal with this piece that was part of our packet this morning, like that, and answer some of the questions we've been having over the last few days.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, good morning. This is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services, and I have provided a written explanation to a question that arose yesterday with regards to the increase, and Representative Smith is here now, so that's good. So this is his question.
All right.
As to the reason for the increase in the net cost of 2001-2003 position actions cost. You may want to turn to the insurance division section, page 5. And it's page 7. The question yesterday was, why has the budget, the governor's budget, increased to $16.6 million from the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget of $14.9 million? And the one reason, one major reason, was the increase in the net cost of 2001-2003 position actions. And the reason for that is basically the reason for the increase in budget, and the budget is because of increase in personal services costs. And if you look on page 7, there are four items. There is the $1.3 million for the net cost of position actions. There's a merit increase of $188,000. Then there's a small number under essential package 010. So that's a little over $17,000. All that leads to an increase of $1.5 million in personal services costs. And basically there are three major reasons for the increase. The first reason is the salaries and wages. There's an increase of $590,754 other funds for salaries and wages. These are the basic salaries and wages. And this is a 7% increase over the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget. The major drivers for this increase are the adjustment for the impact of cost of living increases of 2% that started January 1st of 2002 and the 3% that was supposed to start February 2003. Now, you must have heard about the governor's announcement yesterday that the 3% is not going to take place for management employees, so this number is going to go down. Also, another component is the estimated cost of merit increases for 2003-2005. Now, the legislative fiscal office is going to make that adjustment and remove that. The second reason for this huge increase...
Would you say that again? I think I missed that. Would you say what you just said? I think you're talking about other payroll expenses?
No, before that, mentioned was the estimated cost of 2003-2005 merit increases.
Right.
The $188,000.
Gotcha.
Yes, that is going to be also removed.
Doing
LFO's adjustments. The other elements for the cost increases are the public employee retirement system contributions. You all have heard a lot about this. There's an increase of $471,563 other funds over the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget. The reason for this was the budgeted rate for 2001-2003 was 16.06% of base salary. Now, in the governor's budget, this has increased to 20.28%. And when you add COLAs, the impact of the cost of living increases, as well as the increase in the percentage for PERS, this leads to this huge increase in PERS. The other increase is due to the increase in flexible benefits. There is a $412,680 increase in flexible benefits, and this is because of medical costs. So those are the main reasons for the increase. I have attached a printout that compares the governor's printed budget, 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget, with the 2003-2005 current service level budget. I know we're not supposed to use that term, current service level, but for comparison purposes and to answer your questions, I think when you look at this, you can see clearly what are the elements of the increases. And again, you'll be seeing this for every state agency. The cost drivers are the same. So that's why, although the number of positions has not increased, the increase in salaries that was granted, the PERS rates, and the flexible benefits increases are the reasons for the increase. And the increase in salaries that was approved by the legislature during the emergency board. So we'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask maybe just a general question. It has to do with this budgeting process. And you'll have to forgive me being a new member on this Ways and Means Board, but is it possible to prepare a budget for approval for a two-year cycle that is, in fact, a budget and that can be honored for that two-year cycle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think that is the reason why, I don't think it is possible, I mean, to be frank, that's why we have the emergency boards. The way the budget process works is the legislature, like right now, you all are working on the budget for, you all are working on the 2003-2005 legislatively adopted budget. So that is as you see it right now. So now certain factors take place after the session is over, and the costs need to increase. That's why we have the emergency board, and the agencies appear before the emergency board to get legislative approval.
So, may I follow up with some questions? Mm-hmm. So, we really don't set budgets then.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think we set budgets, majority of the budget, the major portion is set by the legislature, but the legislature always has the changes take place because of a lot of times are factors outside anyone's control, and that's why the agencies need to come before you and seek your permission to have any changes. And I think what you're referring to is you're comparing the legislatively adopted budget together with the you're comparing that with the base budget.
If I may, just to follow up some questions, I guess I'm wondering what were the assumptions that were, you know, I know we can't answer this, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but what were the assumptions when the $14.9 million budget was approved? Were there certain assumptions with respect to certainly FTEs and positions would have been a part of that? So,
Craig, go ahead. You know, one of the issues was we were expecting a lot more money.
Also, Mr. Chair, I would point out that what you have here is the 2001-03 budget, which is the $14.9 million. And then these are the actions that occur to get us to the 2003-05 budget. So we're talking about two separate budget years, biennial budget years. And I'd also say that because of the governor's direction that there be no merit and COLA, you're going to see a lot less adjustment in budgets rolling forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Morris, perhaps I could add some value to the discussion, I'm hoping anyway. The budget that was set, that $14.931 million by the last legislature, anticipated the ability to budget the agency at that point in time, but some things happen after that, and I think that's what Satish was relating to, like collective bargaining agreements happen after that period of time, and so when he talked about the salary and wage increases of 7% that are added into that $1.3 million, that happened after the legislature had already acted on the budget, and so we actually, and DAS actually, had to come back to the legislature and say, we have completed our collective bargaining agreements and we're recommending that the legislature adopt this cost of living increase and we will apply it to all agencies, add it back into their budget. And that was actually done in, I think, the third special session of the legislature. So these are the kind of add-backs. Satish also talked about the fact that the other payroll expenses, that factor because of the cost of supporting the public employee retirement system, that was raised, and those were things that happened after this budget was presented. So the basics of the budget and the basics for what we do and why we do it, you absolutely you determine that in this level. The fine-tuning of those things that can't happen just because of the timing of when they happen have to come back to other people, but they do come back to the legislature. Is that helpful?
It is helpful, but it's not a time and place today for this discussion.
I was just going to say, if you wanted to stop by, maybe we could do a little...
I understand,
yeah.
But I just question the process and the ability to control costs, and that's been one of the major issues in the past several bienniums, is the ability to control cost. And this process that we're looking at here is fundamentally flawed in the ability to control cost, in my judgment.
I think there's some bills out there that are going to try to address some of this, but actually when we passed the budget based on unexpected revenue, which did not turn out to be the case, as we can see from the newspaper showing a massive fall in revenue. But also what happened is in the negotiations occurred that literally offered up more dollars than what had ever been appropriated for it, and here we are. And so the longer you're here, the more frustrated you'll get with that. And particularly, we don't get an economic recovery.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, for 2001-2003, this agency doesn't have emergency board actions, so the legislatively adopted budget is what you see. The $14.9 million is for the current biennium. The number you see, the $16.4 under base budget, that is the starting point for the next biennium, so at least in this case, because they didn't have any major emergency board actions, it is their legislatively approved budget.
Okay, I do understand that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. One observation, adding to what Senator Morris was talking about, is it's interesting that the legislature creates budgets and yet the negotiation for the merit increases occurs completely without legislative review. As a negotiation occurs, does the legislature...
Salary increases, merit increases are a whole separate issue.
Maybe there'd be some time for some 101 education for some of us on how that works at some point in time.
The legislature also established for general fund agencies that was the $100 million mm-hmm. pot that you referred to as a limit for the funds that were available for negotiated increases for covered employees. And so the legislature does set a cap. The legislature is not a party to the negotiations for cost of living adjustments, but does set the parameters under which those negotiations can occur by establishing the amount of money that's available. And as it turned out, the legislature did not allocate all of the funds that it had.
So then what's the discussion? If both sides know where the cap is, what occurs in a labor negotiation then as far as determining what the rate of increase is going to be?
I don't know. I haven't been privy to you know, contract negotiations, and you could ask the Human Resources Division to give you an overview of the contracting process if you'd like.
Representative Hanson?
Yep, maybe I can attempt to help a little bit, and if nothing else, I'll confuse it and muddy the waters that we can move on. When we appropriate an amount, anticipate during the next budget that there's going to be labor negotiations and unions are going to be asking for raises. We set some money aside to cover that. Now, if we as a legislature, said, here's the exact amount that we're giving you, I think we'd be guilty of unfair labor practices mm-hmm. because you're right, there'd be nothing to negotiate at that point. But if we say, okay, here we're just budgeting an amount that we guess is going to cover the costs that are going to be negotiated. And over the last several sessions, the legislature has set that significantly lower than was anticipated, with the idea that during the negotiations process, if the executive department wants to, they can exceed that amount, but they're exceeding it at their own peril, that they're going to have to make it up somewhere else in their programs. So it's still a negotiation process. All we're doing is putting a cap in terms of saying this is the amount the legislature has set aside to pay for this. But if you exceed it, you're going to have to do it through program reductions or holding vacancies open or using some other management tool. And then the emergency board can appropriate part of this pot that we've set aside to cover negotiations. The emergency board can set that out to the ladle that out to the departments, but usually the amount that they're going to give isn't going to be enough to cover the total package of the program, and it still leaves a dynamic of negotiation. We know that it's going to occur, but we just don't know exactly how much, nor can we ever specify exactly how much, because then we're not negotiating anymore.
water's much clearer now.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Pete, help me with something. This came up the other day in Full Ways and Means, I believe that last Friday, and that was that for an agency who's not going to get the increases backfilled by general fund, that $100 million that was sitting in e-board, if they have the ability after that 1995 bill to just go ahead and raise fees, that does that actually occur in order to cover, you know, the non-general fund budgets, or are they going to then use fees to cover that, negotiate a settlement?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question right, are fees going to, are increased?
Oh, okay.
Are increase in fees going to be used for negotiated settlements? In this case, the agency does have a fee bill, and that would be used to cover part of the cost, and I'm sure Greg can address that, but you'll be seeing other budgets too where, yes, salary increases are dependent on fee increases.
And where they have the authority to just go ahead and do it, in other words, and then come back to the legislature for approval, they do that.
They do that.
And I think that gets back to Senator Morris's frustration of the fact that how do you ever get a handle on this?
Mr. Chair, Greg Malcation again. With respect to the question, I want to make sure I understand it right. If you didn't approve merit increases, if the legislature took that out, we would not adjust fees to raise revenues to be able to provide merit increases. We only provide or adjust fees to meet the necessary cost of administering the legislatively approved budget. Does that help?
Senator Morris?
I apologize for belaboring this, but I'd like to just make one point. It would seem to me that this whole process, which there's a great deal of light that's attempted to shed on each of these budgets and make measured decisions with respect to how state funds are going to be allocated, that when the departments come forward with their request for approval, but they make certain anticipations and assumptions within those budgets about what is going to have to happen in the next two-year period, and that we as a body then make a judgment about approving that budget, and that there be, again, the collective bargaining process can still happen with a great deal of integrity within the assumptions that are brought forward and approved. Because you can make adjustments, you know, up or down, and managing the executive branch can manage within that assumption. I guess what it seems to make more sense to me is to have a process that puts more specifics into it at this point, as opposed to a midstream executive. It depends on what the executive branch does. The executive branch may decide that they want to, you know, be very generous. And my concern is, how do we fundamentally structure this so that we stand the best chance of controlling costs? And this is not a labor bashing, it's not a collective bargaining bashing issue, it's just a very simple fiscal approach to how do you manage the state's resources. And it seems to me, you know, as an outsider, I'm totally new to this process, that the process we have has some fundamental flaws in it. And I think they're coming to light here, because then you automatically roll up into a new base. You know, there's no base budgeting. It's just a continuing service level budget, and it just continues to escalate. And I think, as a matter of policy, somewhere along the line, if we can address this issue that puts some fiscal principles into this budgeting process, we'd all be better off. So I guess that's where I'm coming from.
I think there were some ballot measures that tried to get close to doing that. They haven't then been approved so far. Okay, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, in getting back to the schedule, thank you very much. The next division that we'll be visiting about is Building Codes Division, and Mark Long is our administrator from Building Codes. He'll present that. There will be some ties to his presentation that we'll discuss in the next element, which is the fee bill, and it'll explain some of the intricacies between the reduction package as well as a partial restoration package, and we'll try to tie that all together when we get into the fee bill discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of Building Codes Division, and I'm here today to provide you an overview of our budget, our division, its purpose, and our goals. I'll be working from the Building Codes tab, which is in your folder, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you and answer the questions you have. Before I get started, our director, Corey Streisinger, alerted me that there may be some questions about customer service with Building Codes Division or in the Building Code system. And what I'd like to do is, as we go through the presentation, answer your questions, but also I would be available individually to meet with folks offline and really understand some of the issues that are out there and see if I can address your concerns. I'd also like to share with you some of the observations I've had over the last fall while I was working on a regulatory streamlining project for the Department of Administrative Services. As the committee knows, regulatory streamlining is an important discussion right now. And some of the, in that effort, working this last fall, it was clearly communicated to me that our customers want timely services, they want predictable services, that consistent and flexible approaches to building codes regulation needs to be improved in our overall system. And you'll see later in my presentation that our regulatory streamlining efforts and hopefully our customer service efforts will really make a difference for this next biennium. I'd like to get started by focusing on our Building Codes Division mission, kind of our purpose, talk about our accomplishments, what we intend to do next biennium, and then really kind of go through our funding sources. Building Codes' mission is to work with Oregonians to ensure safe construction while supporting a positive business climate. Our division administers a statewide code of regulations that we call specialty codes. And those are really broken up into electrical codes, plumbing codes, structural codes, mechanical codes, boiler elevator, and manufactured housing. We take those code areas in Building Codes Division and break them up into seven program areas in our department. And I'll be referring to those program areas as I go through my presentation. Our purpose is to adopt a statewide code that is consistently administered in all the areas that provide building codes inspections. The purpose of that is so that no matter where a builder or a contractor or a developer or an owner is working, that the same standard is applied whether you're in the North Metro area or the South Coast area or Eastern Oregon, Mid-Willamette Valley. Currently in our system, there are 132 different city and county jurisdictions that we work with to provide building safety inspections and ensure consistent application of the statewide code. Our current system encourages building code services to occur at the local level through city and county building departments. This includes issuing permits, making inspections. It's primarily in the electrical, structural, building, residential areas. When cities and counties elect not to provide those services, then Building Codes Division provides those services in rural parts of Oregon. Currently, we serve about 9% of the population. We're responsible for roughly 2% of the permit activity in site-built construction on a statewide basis. And the remainder, of course, is carried out through local governments. In addition to providing statewide code administration and those inspections in those rural areas, Building Codes Division also provides education and technical consultation to government and industry. We resolve disputes between contractors and local inspectors through an appeals process that was implemented out of the 99 session. We also issue licenses and certifications to tradesperson inspectors. I believe there's roughly 40,000 individual license types. We are individuals that we issue license to on an even annual or biannual or a three-year basis in building codes. We administer training and education programs for inspectors and tradespersons as well. We provide for monitoring of local building department operations, and when appropriate, we take enforcement actions. We have a compliance program as well. One of the things that's new to Building Codes Division that we do that came out of the 99 session was implemented this last biennium was we operate a Tri-County Service Center to really assist contractors and developers working in the Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties to develop consistent forms, processes, fee methodologies, training programs. They do appeals. We work with the 27 jurisdictions that are in that Tri-County area, really trying to provide consistency and bringing local government, the state, and industry together. As a matter of fact, the Tri-County Service Center is really recognized nationally in some of the efforts I'll be talking about later as a real model, again, for bringing folks together and striving for consistency in a particular region. to help building codes carry out its functions, we have six advisory boards that we work with. Some of those boards have policy setting authority, some of them are advisory in nature, and some of them have both. Our boards provide an important role in helping us administrate our responsibilities. It's kind of unique to building codes and unique to government, where on a continual basis, monthly in many cases, quarterly in some, we have stakeholders, industry folks, the general public providing constant input to our operations. The areas our boards help us are in code development, which codes we adopt, code interpretations, the fees we set, the service levels we provide in our program areas, and then they help us with enforcement actions we're taking. What I'd like to do is kind of talk about our accomplishments that we had during this biennium, and then we'll talk about the things we want to work on this next biennium. This last biennium, one of our focal areas was we implemented a statewide minor label program. The minor label program allows minor types of construction permits to be purchased centrally through the state and then usable currently in 132 different jurisdictions statewide. We think that type of system where you can transfer your activity from one area to the next and that permit being recognized by those building departments really goes to streamlining the permitting process, allowing contractors to easily obtain those permits and help try to support a positive business climate in the construction industry. We also worked with our boards and our local government partners to create a statewide code interpretation process, where in this process we proactively try to resolve code disputes, we try to clarify the code, we try to provide for consistent statewide application and clarify the standards. These code interpretations are used, again, region-wide. And again, we think that they support kind of a positive business climate by clarifying what it is that's required of folks. We spent a lot of time this last biennium increasing our outreach efforts through regional forums where we take our program experts and have them go to local jurisdictions, regions of the area. Our attempt is to get the contractor, the inspector, and then our folks in the same room and kind of discuss some of the issues in a local area and make sure we're providing consistent application of the code. We also developed a media campaign called Permits Protect. This is to inform homeowners, primarily in small businesses, about permitting requirements and safety inspections. And that campaign, again, really focused on the safety elements of ensuring safe work and using properly trained people to provide those installations. Also this interim, at the request of the high-tech industry, we developed a semiconductor manufacturing equipment monitoring program, where we worked with, again, our local jurisdictions, the semiconductor industry, and took the review of equipment. In the high-tech community, they're operate awfully quick, and they need to get time to market. It's extremely important to them. And what we did is set up a system where we can, through an oversight program at the state level, monitor the equipment that comes in and go from individual inspection of pieces of equipment for the semiconductor industry to monitoring them on a quarterly or annual basis through the state program. We also worked to provide consistent penalties so that we could make sure that our enforcement actions were predictable to the folks that we serve. And we redesigned our website to make information easier to access and expanded the use of our newsletters so that we can improve our customer information that's available out there in an effort, again, to create statewide consistency. Also, Building Codes implements several key bills each session. There's generally a lot of activity around the construction industry. We track quite a number of bills throughout the process. And last year, there were probably four key ones that really helped improve customer service and kind of set a tone for the functions of Building Codes Division. I'd like to talk just briefly about a couple of those. There was Senate Bill 530, which was a phased submittal bill, which really allowed contractors the flexibility to begin work in phases while their plan review packages were being reviewed in the local jurisdictions. We worked on House Bill 2152 in the electrical program area, where we took 11 limited energy license types and reduced it to 2. I know that sounds like an easy task, but it wasn't. And it really provided clarity and consistency so folks know when they need a license and what the requirements are, and we're very proud of that effort. We implemented House Bill 3613, which created standards for the assumption of local jurisdiction building programs. As I mentioned, there's 132 different jurisdictions out there providing services. And each year, folks can assume or change the makeup of what services they provide, and that bill really provided some structure in that process and allowed us to set some standards for how local governments assume programs. And then lastly, we worked on House Bill 2012, which is called the Master Builder Bill. And in that bill, we created training and education standards for builders and once they can demonstrate competency in the area and familiarity with code, it allows builders to self-verify certain non-life safety inspections. That's pretty, that's kind of a new program. It's fairly unique to Oregon, and we think that sets the stage for some other kinds of programs along those lines. That program is limited to residential development currently, but there's discussion about expanding it. Those initiatives, things that we worked on in those bills, really laid the groundwork for a shift in focus from the division. We were once the main service provider for building codes inspections in the state, and as I indicated, now we're roughly 2% of the activity. And our customers are really asking us to seek a greater role in setting statewide standards, making sure the code is consistently administered statewide, and then resolving disputes through appeals and interpretations, really trying to set standards for folks so that they know what's expected of them. What I'd like to do next is kind of talk about the things we'd like to work on in this next biennium and some of my personal goals, if that's all right. One of my goals is to have Building Codes Division viewed by our customers as a facilitative agency with a high degree of technical expertise. And our focus is to assist customers achieve what they're trying to accomplish while at the same time focusing on the safety issues we're required to carry out. As administrator of the Building Codes Division, I believe the changing focus of our organization and the changing customer expectations in the industry is going to require us to refocus our efforts and find new ways to carry out our mission of statewide code consistency. That seems to be what folks are interested in, predictability, consistency, and flexibility. We need to really work on that. As I mentioned before, the competitive edge for business is now in time to market, and customers want help understanding what's required of them, not just being told. Help them understand the system. And I think it's increasingly vital for us as a division, as well as our local government partners, to really help with timely customer assistance and work through making sure folks understand what's expected of them. To carry out customer service in an organization such as ours and working with all of our different partners, we're going to have to instill some values. And we've already talked to our employees over the last month and a half, asking our employees to do the right thing. I know that sounds cliche, but to strive for flexible, fair approaches and really focus on public safety when they're carrying out their regulatory functions. We've also asked our management team to set specific expectations about customer service and to work with our industry so that there's a clear expectation of what we're going to provide, when we're going to provide it, and it's in partnership with the people we serve. We also want to make sure that we hire employees that have technical ability, that know the code, but also will assist people. You're going to see customer assistance as a focal theme of mine in understanding the regulations in a clear, concise manner. We're going to provide customer assistance training. Again, I think there's a real difference between customer service and customer assistance and helping folks understand what it means to provide customer assistance in a regulatory environment. That isn't real clear, and we need to clarify that as an organization, both internally and externally. And we need to look for ways to provide our services differently, such as using technology, which I'll talk about later, and developing partnerships with our stakeholders. We're going to be trying to find solutions to problems to meet the changing needs of our industry and the expectations of you and the customers that we serve. Over the next biennium, we're going to focus in seven key areas to really strengthen the services that we provide. The first thing we're going to do is continue the successful operations of last session with the Tri-County area and the regional program administration through that office. I think that's been a success, and it's really led to greater consistency and partnership in the metro area. We want to look at the opportunity to expand that or build upon those successes. We want to expand our statewide code interpretation and then continue to streamline permitting processes and implement more types of master permitting processes, such as the minor label program. Something that's extremely important to me is reduce the amount of code amendments. Each year, Building Codes receives twice a year as many as 100 different code amendments to change one of our codes. And we think that in itself creates a problem in leading to consistency. If you're constantly changing the code, how can you ever have your contractors and your inspectors on the same page? Nationally, things are on more of a three-year cycle, and we want to move to that. And we think that's extremely important. We want to enhance our customer outreach share best practices, improve consistency. I think we need to refocus our enforcement efforts to meet our stakeholders' needs and really look at how we can partner up with other agencies that carry out similar functions that we carry out and have similar customers that we serve, such as the Construction Contractors Board. I want to expand the use of statewide, as I indicated, minor labels and statewide master plans. There's a provision in our statute currently that allows an individual who is building duplicate types of projects, either residential or commercial, in more than one area to come to the state and get a plan that can be used anywhere. And not go through the repetitive process of additional plan reviews just because you're building the same building in multiple locations. And we really want to focus on e-governance system. That's going to be something that our organization is going to spend a lot of time. Our customers have told us that they want to be able to apply, pay, and receive regulatory approvals through the Internet. As a matter of fact, we're currently having discussions over the last month with the federal government to showcase Oregon as a pilot state, bringing an e-governance project to the building codes division of the construction industry. We believe we're well positioned to do that. There are really two states in the running for that project. It's Oregon and Pennsylvania. And we think we're well positioned because we have this statewide code model with a consistent code everywhere, because of our relationships with our local jurisdiction partners, because of the tri-county effort that we have, because of the streamlining initiatives, and frankly, because of the support we have of our customer base that want these services. As we continue to have those discussions, there's potential for grant monies to come to Oregon. We're excited about that. And of course, we'll be working with folks to get the appropriate levels of approval should those discussions materialize. What I'd like to do next is kind of talk about our funding and our fee structure. Building Codes is a customer service organization, and we collect fees in those seven program areas I mentioned before. And we collect those fees through three main sources. Permits that we issue, surcharges on permits that are issued in every jurisdiction, and then licenses. Building codes, roughly 55% of our budget comes from permits that we issue. Again, we have just 2% of the activity for structural, mechanical, those kinds of inspections in eastern Oregon and southwest Oregon, but we issue boiler permits, elevator permits, manufactured housing, recreational vehicle, and those kinds of things. The surcharges represent about 30%, and again, those come from any time a permit is issued in local jurisdiction, a portion of that comes to the state to help us carry out statewide code administration. And then the licenses represent about 15% of our budget. Our funds are generally dedicated to the individual program areas, which means it's collecting electrical, it stays in electrical. But this also means that we may have a positive ending fund balance in the overall division, but a particular program could have problems because of that dedication. Currently, we're experiencing that in some of our programs, such as electrical, plumbing, and structural. Our revenue is tied closely to the construction economy because it's based on permit activity. And as such, this last biennium, the division observed a flattening of the economy, especially in the rural areas where we provide services. Anticipating that possible shortfall, we began discussions with our stakeholders and our boards to really develop an action plan that would bring revenue in line with services that we provide. As part of that plan, roughly a year ago, we identified staffing reductions. Through that effort, we permanently reduced 21.5 FTE in Building Codes Division. You'll see that referenced in Package 070. I believe that's on the BCD tab, page 6. 070 has 31.5 total FTE as part of that package. But really, we took and eliminated 21.5 permanently on our own early on the process. And if we don't receive approval for Package 191, we'll have to reduce an additional 9.5 positions. We're asking for that 9.5 positions in Package 191 to be approved. The 21.5 positions really represent about $3.2 million of permanent cost savings in this next budget. Okay, that wasn't a short-term thing. We just did this biennium. It's carried over into the next biennium. The other action we took is we made a commitment to our stakeholders in eastern Oregon to maintain reasonable inspection services. Again, we provide services mostly in northeast Oregon and then some of the south coast areas, Coos and Curry County. In order to carry out those services and maintain some reasonable approach, we increased our electrical permit fees by 25% during this interim. We did establish a plan review fee in the electrical program, and we did update our construction valuation tables for our structural program. We basically took the value of construction. We were operating off of 1994 levels, and we bumped it up to 2001 levels. In addition to those actions we took of reducing positions and establishing fees to offset our rural inspections, we also adopted fees during this interim in three category areas. The first being to maintain our services, which I talked about. But the second, we did establish some fees that were customer requested. I talked about the minor label program, the statewide effort. We had to adopt fees in order to initiate that, and you'll see that as part of the package. And then the high-tech program, where the high-tech community came to us and asked us to provide that oversight of those equipment inspections, we had to adopt a fee structure to provide that as well under a quality control program. Additionally, we adopted fees because of the six legislative actions that we were asked to enact. Senate Bill 530, I talked about the deferred submittal. We adopted fees to carry that out. Senate Bill 932, which is a solar energy licensing system in the electrical program. It's for renewable energy providers. Both the electrical program and the plumbing program created a licensing system, and we adopted fees to implement that. House Bill 3373 created a medical gas installer program. We adopted fees in our plumbing program to do that. House Bill 2012 asked us to establish a master builder program in the structural area for residential. We adopted fees to implement that program. And then House Bill 2899 asked us to create a continuing education program for the boiler area, and we adopted fees to implement that program as well.
I was just going to ask Senator Morris if that helps him understand how come we don't do a balanced budget. We think it's balanced.
Well, there are some improvements we can work on somewhere along the way here.
Mr. Chair, I'm just about done and would be happy to answer your questions. What I would like to point out is when we do establish our fees or have fee increases as such, we work with our stakeholders and our boards. We go through a lengthy process of working with our six boards to make sure they understand what it is we're trying to accomplish and are supportive of the division services. Of course, we go to public comment and we adjust accordingly. Sometimes we make decisions based on that feedback we get. We're asking to continue the fees that were established during the interim. Those fees are contained in House Bill 5059, which I understand we'll be talking about next. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about Building Codes Division or the Building Code System, because it has a lot of interest to folks, and we're interested in trying to improve the system overall.
Mark, are there any fees that you've discussed that didn't have support from the industry that regulated?
Through the chair, Mr. Hansen, no. All the fees were either, again, legislative directed, customer requested, or the ones where we offset our rural inspections. We worked with the electrical industry and the structural industry to raise those fees. So.
Representative Hans, could you hold on for a minute? We're getting real close to the line here on this thing. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 5011 and open the public hearing on 5059, which is the veto.
I won't have to change my question. The hearing kind of slid in under me.
We don't have rules, but we do work.
I think the importance of these is that, you know, as somebody that worked in the industry for a few years, when you're standing around waiting for an inspector to show up, or you're standing in line, or you're taking a lot of time to get a plan approved or get a permit taken out, I mean, cost is money, and I think there's a real recognition within the construction industry that these fees allow the department to do the job that we want them to do and do it in a timely manner, and it really helps them get ahead with their business. And I think you've done a very good job in terms of building support and good conversations within the industries that you regulate to understand and really support what you're doing, and you should be commended on that.
I appreciate that. We have, Mr. Chair, we have a very committed staff that works hard to try to meet the industry needs. We're going to continue to do that.
Greg, you're going to be our leader on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, my name is Greg Malcage, and I'd In introducing the fee bill, I'd like to give just a little background of the process. Before 1995, when the legislature passed Senate Bill 333, fees were generally set in statute, or they were adopted by the agency through a rulemaking process, and that was how they were changed. In 1995, the legislature passed Senate Bill 333 and identified that certain fees needed to go through a new process, and that process still allowed for the agency to go through the rulemaking process, as Mark had indicated, involving stakeholders and the decision-making about those fees and adopting those fees by rule. But then they had to go to the Department of Administrative Services for their approval for adoption at that point in time. And then, with that approval, we do raise those fees under the new Senate Bill 333 process, and then those fees are presented to you in this fee bill for ratification. So these fees have gone through that process. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of these fees that we're passing out a fee matrix to try to provide some clarity or focus on how it's approached, a lot of them are identified as new fees. And these are their new fees, likely because they're tied to an action of the legislature during the last legislative session that said, we want you to do this program, in this case DCBS, and we want we understand that you will have to collect fees, and so we go through that rulemaking process. So the new program has been adopted. We have initiated those programs, identified the fees required to cover the cost of those programs, and now they've been approved by the Department of Administrative Services, and now they come before you to ratify those today, or to consider hearing. I understand that we won't have a work session on the bill. And what we'd like to do is go through the fee matrix, and Mark will touch on the building codes, and I have a couple other programs I'll touch on, and so that you have full information from the agency, and then there is a public hearing where stakeholders have a chance to testify as well. Thank you. So I'd like to turn it over to Mark to kind of walk us through the fee matrix.
Thank you, Greg, Mr. Chair. As Greg indicated, we attempted to take all the fees that were in the bill and provide you really the backdrop and what they're for. I talked a little bit about those in our presentation, but the fees on the first page, I'll probably start off letting the committee know, Building Codes Division collects, I think, roughly $30 million a biennium, but we collect it through a lot of little different fees and seven different programs. So you're gonna see a list of fees, but it's basically because our stakeholders have asked us to have those in the program areas, as I mentioned, and then basically support the functions that folks ask us to carry out. So I'll go through it, and of course, be happy to answer any questions. The fees on the first page, those four, were a result of legislation from last session. The limited renewable energy, the solar heating and cooling, the medical gas installer, and the master builder. We've attempted to identify the statute that it comes from and the program that it's impacted by. If there aren't any questions on the first page, I'll move to the second page, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. Okay. On the second page, the fee towards the top, the continuing education for boiler operators, again, I mentioned that in my overview, that fee came out of last session, so that was a legislative directed action. The Category M fluid service piping certification fee is a leftover from 99 legislation. Back in 99, through House Bill 3383, we were asked to do two things, adopt standards for the regulation of refrigerant piping and process piping. And we did refrigerant piping first in the first go-round, and we did process piping in the second go-round, and so that's why we're here today. The structural mechanical phased projects, which is towards the middle of the page. That's a result of Senate Bill 530. I kind of briefly spoke about that and the deferred plan submittals. The boiler program permits was a result of legislation in 2001, and this was really an action. Because our boiler program permit fees are in statute, some of our fees are in statute, some of them are administrative. It's kind of a mixture depending upon the program and the type of fee. In the boiler program, the permit fee was in statute. Well, the national code that we use to help us understand boiler operations changed in the way they calculate things from a heating surface to a horsepower, so we had to go to the legislature and make those adjustments. And this is really establishing that fee methodology in the boiler statute. It was a, if I recall correctly, last session there was a, there wasn't a fiscal impact. It was negligible. It was just establishing those fees based on that different method, that calculation based on a national code adoption. If there's any questions on the second page.
I think I had the pleasure to carry that bill on in the House, and you can't imagine the incredible high interest of my colleagues as I was explaining the difference between converting from cubic inches to horsepower. I mean, I wish it had been taped and people could play it back at, 11 o'clock at night when they got trouble sleeping. It was a fun experience.
If I would have known that, Mr. Hanson, I could have watched it last night when I was having trouble sleeping. My word. Excuse me. Any questions on page 2? Okay, page 3, we've divided up in our fees that were requested by customers. I talked about the semiconductor program where we worked with the high-tech community to try to put an equipment certification and quality control process in place. And you can see the fees for that. And then the statewide minor label program, which is really one of the more programs that customer service programs we're very proud of, because it does allows an individual to buy a permit from us and use it anywhere in 132 different places. We think that that's very important. And then we established fees for our current operations, and I kind of walked through those a little bit. We established a commercial electrical plan review fee. Fees are typically based on a percentage of the permit. In this case, it was 25% of the whatever the permit would be. And then we did increase our electrical permit and inspection fees by 25%. That's on the third page. Any questions of third page before I move on? Okay. Those electrical fees are continued on the top of page 4 for those permits. Again, those are individual fees based on individual permits that where we serve our electrical industry. And then the other fee we adopted to carry out to support our inspection activities was we adopted the current ICBO table. It's a national table that sets valuation amounts for construction, and we went from the 74 version to the 2001 version. And you can see how where those changes are there. And that's really, from my point of view, the building codes fees as part of the fee bill. Any questions on page 4?
When you do this type of an increase, a total of 25% increase in permit and inspection fees at a time when the industry is down seems high. And so I'm wondering, I assume this reflects cost of operating the division. And I see that you are eliminating some positions, but what do you actually go through before you? I mean, one of these things was a national thing, and when it comes to national fees, I always question those because it varies so much across the state.
Chair Senator Dukes, I think there's two questions there, and I'll try to answer the national. The national fee question. What the national folks do is establish basic construction values for, in this case, structural programs, residential and commercial activity. And then there's an Oregon modifier that's applied based on our local conditions, and it's a little more complicated than what I understand, but that modifier is used. to answer the other question, we adopt fees to support the cost of doing those inspections in those rural areas. So it's cost-based. We work through our boards. You're correct. We did take the actions. And we look at what the impact of adopting that fee would be to our revenue and to our service level, and we adjust accordingly. So the electrical fee, the 25% electrical fee, if I recall correctly, was adopted in September of 2001. Again, because early this biennium, we recognized the shortfall and began to take those actions. I don't recall when the structural fee went into place. But we are very sensitive to the impact to our community. And during this process, we've made sure that our customers are still supportive of those rates. We work very closely with, again, our electrical board and our electrical industry and our structures board and the home builders and developers that we serve. So.
And I'm glad that they're supportive. I would just say that from where I live, my guess would be that if we start increasing fees by 25%, we're going to have more folks doing it themselves without a permit. And that worries me.
It's a concern of ours. One of the challenges for the Building Codes Division, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, is again, that the regions that we have to provide coverage for. I almost contemplated bringing in a map that shows where you provide services, and we actually drive past jurisdictions to provide services in remote areas. Our inspectors, some of them drive as many as 4,000 miles a month providing services in Wheeler, Gillam, Sherman, Wallowa County, Umatilla, those kinds of places. So that also is a factor into us providing those services in those remote areas.
I understand that, but if they stop buying the permits, you won't have that problem.
Senator Morris.
Follow up, Senator Dukes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reduction in FTEs and then raising the fees 25%, the total 0.5% per year, seems to be inconsistent. I guess my question would be, if we were to look at approving by statute the new fees and increase the other fees at 5% per year, can you still deliver the services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if I could address that. When that's how intrinsically this is tied, this fee bill is tied to the budget that we're presenting to you today. We have that 070 package that Mark referred to, which is the 31.08 reduction, and we don't need the fees, these fee increases, to support that level of reduction. In order to provide the service level that Mark was talking about in his presentation, we have an add-back package, policy package 191, which anticipates increase or having staffing of 9.58 additional staff that are actually supported by these increases. So in effect, your approval of this fee bill will allow that package to be included in our budget and provide the services to the public.
Representative Krieger.
It looks like you've got good support from the industry who utilizes the fee to provide the service, but ultimately, I think where Senator Dukes is coming from, somewhere at the bottom end, that consumer, whether it be mom and dad at a little store or building a house, pays that fee. So they have no reason not to support the fee increase because they pass it on. Is that wrong? I don't understand that.
Would you like me to respond, Mr. Chair? My understanding, that's the way the industry operates. We have, and I do have available for you, because also as part of our analysis, we try to see where we line up with our fee structure based on what we're, the services we're trying to provide. And I do have a comparison between what we provide and what some of the other municipalities that are either around us or out there provide. And you can kind of get a sense of where building codes is. And this is with the fees that are part of the bill included in this comparison.
Committee. Representative Hansen. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to Representative Krueger's concerns, if you're bidding a project in rural Oregon, now there's no question that the customer is going to pay for the increase in the fee. That's going to be passed through. But if the fees aren't implemented and the inspection services aren't available on a timely manner, the contractors are going to realize that. Yeah, if I'm doing a project in this particular place, I may not be able to get an inspector down there for 2 days. The flow of the work is going to be erratic because of problems. They're going to build that into the bid. So the customer is going to end up paying for it either way. They're either going to pay it through a pass-through of a fee increase, and oftentimes the fees in terms of an overall project are really a pretty minor cost. Or they're going to pay for it through increased bid costs when the contractor factors in disjointed schedule or delays in inspection or the other thing. So the customer pays for it either way. It's just whether they're going to pay a minor amount on the fee or maybe have a built-in project delay cost built-in in the overall bid. I think that's the reason why the industry supports it.
How do our fees for these type of services delivered by the state or the counties compared to other states that are doing that?
Excuse me, other states in the region?
Yeah, California, Washington, Idaho.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krueger, I'm not sure exactly what the comparison are, and I'd be happy to provide it to you. I would imagine that based on where we kind of line up in the state system, that it would be relatively competitive, but I'd be happy to look into it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I take it these fees are being collected today.
That's correct.
Robin just had a suggestion. If you guys would bear with us, that we get to the public testimony, and then if we have time, because we're...
A couple
more points.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, real quickly, and I think the remaining two areas, if you're on the last page of the fee matrix, you'll see pawnbroker program fee, and that was actually discussed by Mr. Lanter yesterday, and it's a matter of adjusting that fee to a level that will accommodate the minimum required program, and that went through a rulemaking process and was adopted with participation of the stakeholders. And then the insurance division fees on the fee bill were actually touched on by Joel Ario, the insurance administrator, yesterday when he talked about some uniformity issues with federal and provision of certain examinations. Those are the first three fees that are identified there. And then he also talked about the study of the services that we provide to the company services versus the agent services and the importance of maintaining a balance there. And this increase in fee achieves that parity. And associated with this, we did make a change in the amount of the, or actually the timing for the agent license renewal. So it goes down on this side of the equation, and it goes up on the other side of the equation to maintain the parity that he discussed. So thank you very much for letting me complete the testimony on that.
Craig, do the pawnbrokers have any idea that we're talking about this fee today? I mean, were they notified in any way, or they weren't?
Okay. Yeah, it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that we tried to not only include them in the rulemaking process, but also make sure that they're aware of any action that's related to this. Thank you very much.
Senator Moore.
I just have to ask my accounts receivable question. Do you have an age analysis that's on your collections that would...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think we provided that to you in our letter. I think it might have been the first day.
We've already covered that.
Yes, I can certainly review that with you and identify the letter. It was, we brought that in on February 10th, and I'll make sure that you get another copy. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
For review. At this time, I would ask, in order that we're signing up, we would have all three of you come up here, and then we'll ask the others later. Jim Muir, Ron Murray, and Jared Broadfoot. Excuse me. And that was the one that was written clearly.
All right.
I guess we'll have Jim go first. You're up first.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Muir, and I'm the building official of Washington County, second largest jurisdiction, local jurisdiction in the state, and we represent a rather diverse jurisdiction in that we cover everything from the urban Nike and Intel projects to small buildings on the Coast Range, and I am the co-chair of Oregon Building Officials Legislative Committee, and that... That group is here to support Building Codes Division's fee increase and budget request, and I'm available to answer any questions. I'm also the chairman of the Tri-County Public Outreach Committee that Mark referred to in his testimony, and have been involved in those processes, BCD processes, and code change processes in the state for the last 10 years.
Is it your feeling that efforts the agency's made to streamline, you know, the movement towards internet exchange and that sort of stuff, is that going to be beneficial to the folks that you serve?
It is, and in our jurisdiction, we've established, about 7 years ago, we established a partnering program, which is really a version of the streamlining program, where we're working with the stakeholders early on in projects to make sure that it runs smoothly and that they get their permits out on time, that they get their projects done on time, and that they are an economic benefit to the state of Oregon. And that process is, our process in Washington County has actually received national recognition through the National Organization of Counties, and it's the same sort of process that Mark referred to in streamlining efforts with Building Codes Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray, and I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters Local 290, and we are probably one of the largest single stakeholder groups of the Building Code Division in Oregon. As a sidebar, I also sit on the Tri-County Industry Advisory Council up in the metropolitan area, and so work very closely with building code divisions and local and state building officials on many of the different issues. I'm here to provide testimony in support of the budget and fees of the building code division. Mr. Long was correct in stating that industry is concerned with compliance, consistent code enforcement throughout the state of Oregon, consistent codes and so forth and so on. And we have the utmost confidence in the staff, both the management and the staff, at all levels in the building code division. To talk about some of the technicalities of the budget, I would be remiss in representing the plumbing and steam fitting industry if I didn't mention that even with the upgraded budget package, there will be a loss of one FTE in the plumbing program. Understanding budget cuts and so forth and so on, I can understand where that is a realistic loss. However, the plumbing program actually has a budget surplus, and that there is money that is transferred out of the plumbing program to support other programs. So that makes this loss a little bit more difficult to accept. However, working with Mr. Long, we believe that this is going to be worked upon in the next few months, and we would like to give Mr. Long the opportunity to do so, but I do want to bring that to your attention. Another concern I think that all of the building industry has is exactly how much overhead Building Code Division has to pay to DCBS. out of approximately a $30 million budget, and perhaps Senator Morris could work on this one for me because we can't get a number, but that it is a substantial amount of money that actually leaves the division to pay for overhead expenses. And that's a very real concern, I think, to the entire building industry. But with that, we would ask that you support this budget. And I think that Representative Krieger had a good point. Yes, they are fees. And someone is ultimately going to have to pay for them. But when we talk about the smaller incremental steps that the fee increases have and so forth and so on, it's overwhelmed by the cost of project delays and so forth and so on. And one of our guiding lights, I think, is that we are just so immensely interested in a regulatory streamlining to bring more industry to the state of Oregon. And we think that what the high-tech industry and the construction industry is looking for is an opportunity to have prompt inspections, consistent inspections from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and so forth and so on. And we actually have the utmost confidence that, the Building Code Division is providing that. And if I could answer any questions.
I personally find it interesting that most people that I talk to, they're more concerned about the delay than they were about the fee. And that's because it really is irritating if you're trying to move a project and there's nobody there to do an inspection, so everything comes to a stop. And so I can see your concern on that issue. Is that it costs a lot of money to have a crew standing by.
And the other thing that is that is really significant is, and we've worked very closely with Mr. Muir from Washington County and the other folks in the Tri-County area. We have 27 different building jurisdictions, and literally you could have one inspector make one call on one side of the street and you're in a different jurisdiction on the across the street, literally. You can have four corners of a block and each have a different inspector, and they each see things differently. And Building Codes Division has done tremendous work that we all see things the same way. Right or wrong, at least we're going to see it the same way, and that really helps the process. So. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, here today representing two of our clients, the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Combined, our contractors represent over 1,000 contractors with an average of 10 employees per contractor. Our clients pay for a significant portion of the Building Codes Division budget, and I am here today to express our clients' united support for House Bill 5059 and the fee increase. I wanted to touch on several items that was mentioned that industry asked for. Two of those being the implementation of the minor label program statewide for plumbing and electrical. And we've had discussion here today about the fees getting passed on to the customer, and in this specific case, a minor label allows a contractor to, let's say it's on a weekend, a Saturday or Sunday, a local jurisdiction isn't open, and someone calls and says, I need some work done. And if it is within the scope of that minor label, the contractor can complete the work and be done rather than having to file a permit, go through an emergency permit process. So in that case, and we've asked for this to be spread throughout the state so we can provide better customer service from our contractors to the customers who are needing the work done. The second point I wanted to make was that two of the fees that we're asking for were to maintain inspection services in rural Oregon. It's imperative that we maintain the inspection services in rural Oregon, especially because of, in some cases, we don't maintain as many hours as we should because of the lack of funding for those local jurisdictions or for the state. So we feel that it's absolutely imperative for the customers, number one, and the contractors, second, so we can get inspections completed and complete the jobs without holding them up and costing everybody money. There was also mention about the e-permitting, the online permitting, and our industry is supportive of that. And in case in point, in rural Oregon, if someone wants to take out a permit and has to drive 45 minutes to take that permit out, and then drive 45 minutes back if they can get that the permit in the time they are in there. But in some cases, they have to go back several times because of the low staffing to do so. So if online permitting was available, they would be able to complete that process almost immediately and continue work. Like I said, the electrical and plumbing industry is very supportive of this fee increase. We've asked for it. It's gone through the public hearing process where not only industry was able to give input, but the customers as well. I also sit on the Electrical and Elevator Board's policy committee for the state, and we have reviewed many of these issues as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. I guess I'd throw this question out to all three of you gentlemen. I'm still confused on how a fee increase is going to expedite the timing of the inspections, or it's going to increase the efficiency. I guess I'm further confused. We're not talking about adding new inspectors. We actually heard that we are going to lose one FTE. So I need help, if I'm going to vote for a fee increase, to understand how raising the fee is going to expedite the timing of the inspections, how it's going to increase efficiency when we're losing workers. And I guess from your folks' perspective who work with these folks, how does that occur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, as an example of, and they've been provided, I think things like e-permitting, streamlining, improving fees and processes, policies and processes that accommodate more inspections per day, quicker permitting and plan review. And one thing that wasn't mentioned here, and that's a big portion of all the jurisdictions, is plan review, and that is where you submit a set of plans and they have to be approved. BCD supports the plan review process for all of us local jurisdictions by making the by adopting the code, providing local plan review service in areas that we don't actually have a local jurisdiction. And I'm trying to think of other examples, but it's just not inspectors. We're just not adding inspectors. We're improving the whole organization to run smoothly. There's a big compliance program here as far as making sure that the licensed people are doing the work rather than the unlicensed people. So there's a lot of components to a building department that don't necessarily relate to adding an inspector, but making that inspector efficient. For instance, in my jurisdiction, you call in on a phone line and request an inspection on an interactive voice response system. It's printed out automatically in the morning on a computer and handed out to the inspectors. 10 years ago, that was all handwritten. You talked to somebody on the phone. They wrote it out. They then passed it along to the inspector. The inspector wrote everything out. Somebody then typed it all back in. So all this has to do with efficiencies for the industry, for the customer. And those efficiencies, they cost money. It costs money to put systems in place to offer those types of services. And the fees support that entire program, not just an inspector. We're not just adding an inspector. So we're covering a whole program.
We're going to ask Greg to address this tomorrow, but really quickly, I guess just a nodding of the head would be adequate. Do you believe then that what the agency's talked about as far as the things they intend to do, that those will occur because of the package?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, they've already begun to occur years ago. I mean, the Tri-County process that's in place in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties, they're based out of there, but they have a wide-reaching effect on what we've done as far as improving systems and policies and ways we conduct business. So, and the support we've gotten from industry and the buy-in from the various building departments in conjunction with BCD to make all these things happen is really what we're talking about. We're not speaking to individual inspector funding.
Mr. Chair, if I might just give a quick response, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. To answer your question, by passing this or by voting for this fee increase, what we're going to do is stop a further reduction of 9.5 FTEs, and those are the inspectors. So what we're going to do is stop a further reduction, and what our support is for is keeping these 9.5 FTEs and not further reducing the level of service that is being provided. We're very leery of losing these positions because it's going to have a direct effect on inspections.
Okay, well, we thank the three of you very much. And at this time, I would ask Amanda Rich and Ralph Roner to come on up. I saw you nodding your head, so we have the answer to what you're going to say.
Careful.
It's your day.
I need to warn you, I expect you to be very nice today.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. I am essentially here today to echo the sentiments that you've heard from my colleagues in support of Building Codes Division and their fee bill, House Bill 5059. Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors represents over 150 members statewide. And as a statewide organization, we deal with those 132 local jurisdictions that you heard Mr. Long talk about. Without a functional building codes division, when we're dealing with a code issue, we have to deal with 132 different local jurisdictions. As you can imagine, that would be nearly impossible. With a good, healthy relationship with a strong building codes division, we're able to deal with one entity in trying to solve issues of code interpretation and consistency of enforcement. And so it is vital to us that and to our our members' ability to do business, that we have a healthy building codes division, essentially. And I guess I would just add one more piece that I haven't really heard talked about this morning. And Oregon is in the midst of struggling to recover economically. And frankly, it is, as you know, in construction, time is money, and we are going to rely heavily on construction to try to, turn this economy around. And we just can't afford delays in the permit process and breaks in service as we're doing what we can to try to revitalize Oregon's economy. We're here trying to keep Oregonians working and keep them safe and provide good customer service. And BCD, a strong BCD, is a partner in that. And we just urge your support of this bill so they can continue to do what they do.
Thank you, Amanda.
Oh, and I will take any questions if you have any. But I'm sure you'd much rather hear from Ralph.
We're safe.
Oh, you are?
You don't have a nice sheet like she does.
We don't have that kind of money.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, by the way, my name is, for the record, Ralph Groner, representing ASME. Nice to meet you, Senator Morris. I've actually called you once, and I find the first time I've seen him is here. I represent one, the employees of BCD, but also most cities and your counties in Oregon, the inspectors, the worker bees. So we have what's called lovingly in this building, the group, and the group you've heard a good number of them today, but where we are unique when it comes to the building industry is that business, labor, cooperate together so that when a bill comes out, it comes to the group. We discuss the bill. We go over the pros and cons. I usually end up compromising. They don't. And then we come back. No, I'm kidding. We come in support of a package which legislators that chair the appropriate committees have appreciated. Originally, when I wanted to testify on the fee bill, I
forgot to say, I don't know, Mark, didn't we lay off 21?
We permanently reduced 21 FTE.
Permanently reduced 21 FTE already, so my concern is not just for my staff, but looking back when I voted as a legislator here to begin building codes in 1973, Fred Van Atta's bill, but I had the opportunity to help pass it. The intent was to have a concerted effort to have oversight and consistency by the legislature in this state so that we didn't have all these jurisdictions going their own way, so that when you had to go to, that was the intent in 73, and I only want to comment that I feel, especially with Mark Long coming on, he's brand new. Mark worked there for years, but he was sent to DAS, and then the various governors have wanted him to streamline because he's one of these bright people, and they moved him quickly back to BCD, just came back, because he's kind of the streamlining guru. I only want to say this. One, that my feelings are that I think this system may be cattywampus, and I'm the only one that's going to testify to this. The trades all understand this system. You pass a bill, you pass two bills over here that say, go do this, last session. So they take the fee issue to pay for this through this elongated process. I don't know if Mark drew it. I was up with some legislators just now on the board. It's like seven steps. You know, it's like my 15 points with AA, and only it's worse. And so what happens is the folks go through this process, public hearings, boards, respective boards, and they finally get approval after this very long process that had all these hearings that you've all concurred or not concurred on, worked it out, and then even now they hire the staff, put the staff on to appropriately begin the program that was approved by you. Then they come back here after it's all done and the people are hired to provide this system, and they ask, can they have this fee increase? I think there's a systematic problem, and I would appreciate it. I liked hearing Senator Moore's comment because, frankly, I think this needs to be streamlined. Excuse me, I wanted to throw that at you. I probably alienated everybody. I don't mean to. But from a little union guy, this just doesn't work. The bills have passed. By the way, the question we heard, with the comment we've all heard, why we're all here and nervous from the group, is that you somehow were told or told us that there will be no new fee bills passed. So I've gone upstairs and been talking to every legislator I can find, even while you were here. And yesterday and so forth, lunch with folks and talking to them. And they were talking what I'm hearing about backfill directions, not questions of fees for existing programs, or even if it were approved, a new program that's going to help the economy. So I want to make that very clear, that the clarification is not to deal with fees such as this, at least when you talk to legislators, and they make the decision here, and that's what I'm hearing from them. I only want to say the following. This union has testified in front of the Transportation Commission, in front of, and I don't even have folks who work on new construction. I don't have the folks who build the bridges. That's the trades. But the truth is, I have worked overtime to help stimulate the economy and do my share for you, and to lobby, lobby, lobby. A good part of the registration fee increase came first from this union way back to get the bridges fixed. That's coming to you. But it also will hire family wage jobs to get them paying income taxes. But the second part of that, and I never want to forget maintenance for our local government, because that also stimulates. But the third component's in front of you. And that is, Mark and this agency have led the way, you heard it, streamline. So that in fact, if Morris Brothers comes in, I hate to pick that company, but it just came right out of the air, comes in for a permit, if you go to the sample that we passed, some, what was the bill, 5-1? Tri-County.
512.
I can't remember all these hundreds of bills. That was supposed to, if I look at it, to go to a statewide model. The model you heard is folks now in all those jurisdictions realize they're going to have consistency. I want to see that statewide. So do my members. Because that makes it easier for them. And I would hope you'll see that building codes has led the way in that. An example of that is
I wanted to know why projects for industrial were taking so long. Not only have we had a shortage of land, but at the building permit process. So I went to folks and found out why. We have too many inbuilt, oftentimes, inside the various counties, too many agencies to deal with. So we're talking about streamlining that if we're talking major jobs and corporations coming in. So, bottom line, Mark has done a wonderful job. We are a union, but we're a partner in all of this, and Representative Krieger wants to ask me a question, so I'm going to shut up rapidly.
Okay. We need to hurry.
Chair, if it's okay, I've noticed, and it means you've got this institutional memory, you know, for so long back. As people have come up today, we've, you know, Mr. Smith, it's all these different, Mr. Broadfoot, Mr. Groner, but when we get to budget analyst Saddish, we stop. Would you explain that?
Now, what did you just say?
In other words, we're not saying his last name. How come no one's saying the guy's last name, this gentleman's last name?
The analyst?
Yeah. Nobody can pronounce it.
Oh, right. I can do it once or twice.
I can
I've
tell
never
you.
Heard anybody refer to him. I thought this guy could tell us.
No, Representative Krieger, it's not Groner, so I can't pronounce it. I just don't. I'm sorry. I don't know.
I'm just giving a bad time. But how do you pronounce the name?
To Florida in a little
yeah.
bit.
Padilla. All right.
Yes, my only comment on former Representative Groner's testimony is the suggestion that in AA there are 15 staff.
Oh, I don't know.
As a member, I took 12, but I...
Oh, that's... They gave me an extra 3.
Well, now he gets there, he'll probably need...
They gave me an extra 3!
You have him embarrassed, which normally he does that to me. All right, I want to thank everyone.
Thank
with
you.
That, we'll close the public testimony in the hearing on House Bill 5059.
Probably give him these 15 steps in there.